Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell, and I'm sitting here with Sarah McDewling, and we're across from Lee Child. Sarah and I were talking about it a little bit earlier. We're a little bit nervous about this one because both of us love the books. And
it's Lee Child.
Yeah, and that part. Welcome, Lee.
Thank you. It's great to be here. And I sort of know what you mean, because I'm always a little worried about meeting an author whose books I like, just in case I don't like the person. That could be, that's a very awkward thing. If you love the book and then you end up hating the person, what are you going to do about the books in the future?
We're fine on that score.
That's the thing. All those questions about people who do things wrong and their work is still out there, whether or not you can actually enjoy the work or not. I will always enjoy the work. It's the work that I'm in love with in the first place. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. You mean about like actors who turn out to be bad guys and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, you can't suddenly turn against the work they've done because that's not actually them. They're acting. There's a clue in the word.
Yeah. And we're here to talk about Past Tense, which is your 23rd Jack Reacher.
In 21 years.
But how'd you do that? That's just...
Well, that is, there's a slight sort of mathematical illusion there, because I finished writing the first book in 95, and then it feeds into the publishing machine, and it came out in 97. And I figured that I want to publish a book a year, therefore I've got to write a book a year. Therefore, the second book and some of the third book was written before the first book ever came out, because of the long delay through the sausage machine.
Yeah.
And then what happened was in 2010, which is now 8 years ago, I was still always a year ahead. The publisher had the new manuscript before the previous book came out. They always had a year in hand. But then in 2010, it was because 61 Hours, which was the spring of 2010, had a really dramatic ending where it was sort of unclear had Reacher survived. Mm-hmm. And so they were worried about people worrying about it. And so they then brought out the next book very quickly, within 6 months. And so they burned their spare year.
Ah.
And so it's 23 books in 21 years sounds like hard work, but actually I've never written more than one book a year. But now I'm in the same situation that most authors are. I write it just in time, and it gets published more or less straight away.
And where in the middle of your writing? This is an interruption of your writing process.
It is, because publication date now has shifted into my writing season. And so I always start on September the 1st. And so this year I did, obviously, and I'm about a third of the way through the 2019 book. Had to break off to come and publicize number 23.
Well, thank you. We're glad that you did that.
And how long has that process been interrupted? Is that now part of your process, this interruption?
Yeah, I mean, what it is I try and get a really good start in September. I try and somehow get the feel, get the mood, set the course. And I'm not usually that worried about how much I've done before Christmas, because then as long as I know what the track is, then I can really get into it after Christmas, and then I'm completely undisturbed in January, February, March, usually finish in March or April. But actually this year I did pretty good. I'm about a third of the way through the book. I did a good September and October. I probably won't have that much time between the end of this tour and Christmas, but I'll get a little bit more done. And so it'll be relatively relaxed for me, actually, January, February, March.
In the beginning of this book, Reacher decides to go from Maine to San Diego, but gets sort of stopped in New Hampshire because of a recollection that his father grew up in the town that the street sign says is down that way.
Mm.
And so he wanders down to see where his father comes from. That happened, well, that decision was made largely around the first paragraphs that you...
Yeah.
I'm so fascinated that you can start the book.
And
then just not know where it will go.
Well, you guys must know, because you talk to so many authors, that if you have 10 authors, you're going to get 11 different ways of doing it. And some people do tremendously detailed outlines. My friend Jeffrey Deaver, for instance, does a 300-page outline that he then turns into the novel. Lots of people work like that. Other people have jotted notes, or they have a kind of deck of index cards with scenes on and so on. But for me, it's about the story. I just love story, just as simple as that. And if I were to make any notes, if I was to plot it out in any way at all, then that story is told. And I'm done with it. I want to move on to the next story. So it's very important for me not to know what's going to happen. I just need to start somewhere and see what happens. And the thing is, as you say, this is book number 23, so I've done this 22 times before. Feels terribly insecure. It feels like a real high wire act. You're certain to fall off. You're certain to, this year it's going to be a disaster. Nothing is going to happen. But it always does. And what I've learned to do is just, I suppose, trust my subconscious. And I write the opening paragraph. And I just try and make a good opening paragraph. And then I think, all right, what comes next? And in this particular opening paragraph, I felt there were two tiny little subconscious clues to myself. One was a mention of the bird watching. There's ornithological imagery in the opening paragraph. And I'm thinking, well, why did I do that? And that relates to something that I wrote many, many books ago when I was trying to say something about Reacher's father, who was a Marine infantry officer and a real hard guy, you know, a stone killer. But I wanted to humanize him a little bit. So all those years ago, I said his hobby was bird watching, you know, which is generally a very pleasant and sweet thing to do. So I'd set up this character, this hard military man who also liked birds. So I realized, oh, I've used bird watching imagery in the opening paragraph. Maybe this book is about Rich's dad. And I think a lot of people are going to connect is that my own father had just died. And it's not that I was upset about it necessarily, because he'd been in very poor shape for a number of years, and it was really time for him to go. You know, if you're unsentimental about it, you would say it's a mercy and so on. But it was more that it just made me ruminate a little bit. You know, he died. He was my dad. Obviously, by definition, I'd known him all my life. But had I? You know, how well can you ever know another person? Hmm. Even your partner, even your family, maybe your children, how well do you know them ultimately? So I thought, maybe Reacher's dad has got secrets or something that we don't know about him. So it was sort of an exploration of that. And also in the first paragraph, I mentioned the word Maine, state of Maine. Reacher had spent the end of the summer in a small town on the coast of Maine. And I thought, well, why did I mention Maine? And I thought, oh, Stephen King lives in Maine. And that gave me the idea, maybe we can add a second strand to this book that is kind of Stephen King-like, a creepy, because Stephen is an absolute master of setting up something that looks totally ordinary, just ordinary people doing ordinary things, and yet you know that it's really sinister, something bad is going to happen. So I thought, could I do that? So that half of the book is my attempt at a sort of Stephen King-ish type of strand, and the other part is about Reacher's dad.
I love the fact that those two start close to the beginning and you get, like, there's that momentum. You just know that they're going to grow together.
Eventually they're going to get together.
And you play with us so long in this book.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the suspense. I mean, there's a suspense of what is going to happen to the two people in the creepy situation, but also the suspense, when is Reacher going to get involved?
Yeah.
Like, where is he? Where is he? That sort of suspense. And but again, that was organic. I suppose subconsciously I expected Reacher to get involved much earlier. But they were doing fine on their own. You know, the two Canadians were doing great on their own, just page after page. They were ended up pretty resourceful. Mm. So Reacher just was postponed and postponed, and everybody's thinking, where is he? When's he going to arrive? And I like that, because that was another component to the suspense.
Mm. When that book came out, Reacher said nothing, where the academic sat behind you when you wrote Make Me, was mm-hmm. it? I grabbed it and went, great, now I'm going to have the secret to Lee Child. This is brilliant. I'll be writing thrillers and making millions of dollars. I read it and I got to the end and went, hey, I don't know the secret. What gives? Yeah. What is really interesting about the way you write? And, you know, there's that feeling that it must be easy if he's that casual about it, sits down and writes a paragraph and always on September and knows he's going to finish in March. What the guy could not get is your reading history, your past work, there's a whole range of things that pile into your brain over 20, 30 years. And I'm very interested in the story making before you became a writer in the working for Granada Television, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And that is absolutely right. I mean, that's a very perceptive thing, that actually it's not about the year that you're writing the book. It's about your entire life before that. And I'd sort of lived on twin tracks, where I worked in entertainment, briefly in the theatre and then mostly in television, which trains, you know, it imprints on your DNA. I did 40,000 hours of television of all different kinds, some of it news, documentary, and so on, and a lot of it drama and soap opera and so on. And it kind of literally reshapes your DNA to understand that rhythm and the grammar of cliffhangers, the speed at which you should dole out information. It became completely instinctive to me. And of course, the other track of my entire life was reading. Mm. And so I've read literally tens of thousands of books in my genre, which again kind of trains your DNA so that, for instance, I never, ever, ever have to think about the end of a chapter or the end of a sequence. It's just obviously is. You know, I never think, oh, should I end the chapter there? It just ends there. It's automatic. It's obvious. And so you're quite right. You know, the year that I'm writing the book is the tiniest, tiniest tip of the iceberg. And what you don't see is that lifetime of exposure to other people's entertainment. Mm.
And I remember reading about your, you will pick up the latest book of your favorite author and gobble it down just like a fan does every mm-hmm. every year. Do you read it as a reader or read it as a writer?
Both, you know, and that's been very interesting to me as I became a writer, that if it's fairly close to what I could do myself, then it is, I'm reading it like a writer, which is to say I'm enjoying it, absolutely. I'm loving it like any other reader, but I've got a commentary track. You know, when you switch on the commentary track on your DVD, mm. I've got that running in my head. So that as well as enjoying the book, I'm thinking, I see what you're doing there. And you realize, you know, what you're going to have to do this in about two or three pages. And then, and that's actually great because usually they satisfy me, you know, they hit all the marks, it's great. But then once in a while, they do something that I wouldn't have done or I couldn't see coming. And I just think, wow, okay, that's pretty good.
we were talking before the podcast about how this is truly one of those series that you can pick up anywhere. Like they say it of a lot of series, but this one, I feel confident anyone could pick up any book and just dive right in. How do you do that?
Well, part of it is characterizing of Richard himself, because he's not the guy that ever dwells on the past. You know, he's not interested in what has happened already. So partly it characterizes him. Partly I wanted to stay away from any self-referential stuff, because I cannot bear those exchanges of dialogue in certain series where somebody says to her, hey, you remember that affair down at the Penguin offices in Sydney where this happened? And you say, oh, yeah, and we had to do that. You know, I just think it's so artificial. Mm. I really don't like that at all. So partly to avoid that, partly to characterize Reacher as a guy who only looks at today, maybe a little bit of tomorrow, certainly nothing about yesterday. That was the way I wanted to write it. And I realized that it's a great commercial advantage because in the real world, let's say you say to a friend, oh, the Reacher series is really good. If she had to start at book one, then there's always the slight possibility the bookstore is not going to have book one, or it's going to be laborious getting it. She's got to go online and order it or something. And the tiniest obstacle in the way of grabbing a book is going to stop some people from getting it. You know, if you walk into a bookstore, it's not there. You forget about it within half an hour, you know, and then read somebody else. And so I felt commercially, as well as the character of the story, it needed to be, each one is a standalone. And the format of the Reacher books is that it's what I would call an anti-soap opera. In other words, it's not a collective thing. It is not a location-based or employment-based soap opera. There are no other recurring characters. There are no other recurring scenarios. You don't need to know anything at all. It's just one guy on his own. And that also gives me fantastic flexibility so that, the new one, past tense, is literally set in the woods. You know, there's no police involved. There's no nothing. Whereas other of the books have been high concept with the White House involved, FBI, CIA. I can do whatever I want. And that means that each September 1st, when I sit down to write the new one, it's fresh. It's great. You know, it's like I'm writing my first book ever. It's not like, oh, some weary continuation of an ongoing thing.
And tied into that way of writing, you said there's no reoccurring characters, but every time I read one of the books, I do kind of fall for these side characters, and then you never see them again.
Yeah,
is that hard for you as a writer?
It is, totally. I mean, totally. I remember writing the first book, Killing Floor, and I knew that none of those characters would recur because of that decision I'd taken. And I had tears in my eyes at the end of it, saying goodbye to those characters. You know, I'd lived with them for 6 months, and I loved them. And I knew they were gone, and it was a very intense feeling, yeah.
It's a special thing about it, because I think it would be easy for your side characters, you know, to be interchangeable as they change for each book. But it never is that way. Like, I haven't finished past tense, but I'm already in love with Patty, and it's going to be rough.
Like, yeah, it totally is, and I feel exactly the same as you, that, Patty and Shorty, they were a great pair. She's lovely. He was a bit thick at the beginning. he's a bit hopeless, actually, but I like him, you know, and they, to a large extent, kind of took over the book, and I was really enjoying their company. Now they're gone, and my only consolation is that now I'm inventing some new ones for the new book, so I can sort of, I can bear it because I've got new things in my head, and hopefully the readers will get into next year's book, and they'll quickly forget Patty and Shorty, and they'll be into the new people.
So is he right, like in this one, I mean, I won't go into any details, but the way in which you write, where you're not really sure what's coming up, these people live that experience and seem to learn by the experience as they're going through it. And so gather, and Risha does as well, but the Patty and Shorty in this one are thrown into a circumstance that they're just outside their experience.
Richard,
and they
always just knows.
Yeah.
Richard just...
But, yeah, he does adjust.
Like
if something goes wrong in a particular moment where he's thought one thing and it goes in a different direction, then he adjusts on his feet. But the style of writing actually allows for character growth. Do you find that? That the experience of living the novel as you live it, that these characters are learning?
Yeah, I would sort of cast that sentence slightly the opposite. It's not that it allows for character growth. It does not limit it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think if you have an outline, like the 300-page detailed outline guys, that's a bit of a straitjacket. I imagine you would feel, if you're writing it and you really feel somehow organically, instinctively, that the character should go off into a certain direction, you kind of can't, because then that screws up the rest of the outline. So that doing it without an outline removes any boundaries, and so anybody can do anything. And I find it unfolds quite organically. I don't know how far you are through it, but Shorty to some extent rehabilitates himself. He starts out a bit thick and hopeless, but towards the end he has a couple of good ideas. And I'm pretty sure that I would not have mapped it out that way had I done an outline.
Mm. Yeah. Well, that character growth and the movement of the books. I've not read anyone else who writes in the way that you do, who is able to create that moment. There's a movement which is outside of all other suspense, which is a Jack Reacher novel. It's a different kind of movement.
Yeah.
And it's because, I think it's because of the way you do it. I don't think it's any technique you've got, but I think there are techniques in the sense of the suspense of how those two are going to join. That's one sort of suspense. But then there's this glacial stuff that's going on beneath, which I think Murakami, when he admitted to his absolute obsession with your books, was going, why? Why am I obsessed with these? Why can I not put these damn things down?
I think it's because something... Do you want my theory?
Yeah, I want to. Let's go.
I think it's because part of your discovery process as you're finding out what happens while you write bleeds in. And so your pleasure and joy of finding these things out is sort of inherent in the book be shared by the reader.
I think that's absolutely right. I think you've put your finger on it, that I know in myself the absolute joy of it might only be half a page, or it could be a whole chapter. We suddenly veer off in a different direction, and I do it with such joy and enthusiasm because, wow, yeah, great, this is happening now. And so I'm constantly excited about these random new directions. And I'm sure that bleeds through. And the other thing is that, and Murakami and people like that should know this, is that technically in the writing there is, it's all about the rhythm constantly tipping forward.
Mm.
It's like music in the sense that you can organize the beats in the sentence to constantly push forward, rather than just keep it with an equanimity, rather than keep it slow. You can write in a way that just the rhythm springs and trips forward the whole time. And if you do it well, nobody notices it, except that they notice, wow, I'm rushing through this book, and I finished it in a day. And that is partly because of the content, but mostly it's because of the technique, honestly.
Well, that's really obvious when you say it, because you start looking, because I remember hearing you say something like that in the Regis Said Nothing, and I went back and had a look closely at some of the text, and looking at the way in which you pace the language. And I'm not a genius with all that side of things. I'm not a poet, and I don't understand language in the way you explain it in the book. But when you actually start looking into this, and are people doing PhDs and stuff on your work? Are you getting people coming to you with these kind of deep philosophical theories about your work?
Yeah, I am, and I find it bizarre, to be honest. But there are a couple, constantly people are getting in touch with, they're doing a PhD, and they, can they do this interview or ask me these questions? And I say, yeah, knock yourself out, but you should be doing something more serious with your time.
Lee, we're kind of run out of time, but
I want to talk about the TV show a little bit.
Oh, yeah,
just a little bit. Recently announced.
Yeah, this is our extra time.
Yeah, just in just for a few minutes.
Sure.
So for podcast listeners, it was recently announced that the movies of the Jack Reacher, Tom Cruise variety are no more.
Correct.
And there will be a TV show coming. What level of involvement will you have in that?
I as much as I think is safe is the answer to that. And I say that because I think it's actually a very bad mistake for a book writer to be over-involved in writing the screenplay for any adaptation. Because even though we're moving it from a movie which is short to a binge-watching season, which might be 10 or 12 hours, there's still a tremendous amount of chopping to be done, a lot of editing, you've really got to rip it apart and then put it back together in a way that suits the medium. And I think a book writer is way too close to the material to do that effectively. With great respect, I would say that Gone Girl, I loved that book. I thought Gone Girl was a fabulous book. I had none of the usual objections to it. Some people talk about the end and so on and so forth. I loved Gone Girl, thought it was great. But then Gillian did her own screenplay for the movie, and I think most people would agree the movie is way too baggy and overlong. And that is because the book writer himself cannot have the necessary degree of brutality and callousness that is required. And I know that because I've done it to other people's stuff. I've done it to, as a third party, I've done it to other people's stuff. And you really have got to, you take a machete to it. And that's very hard to do with your own stuff because, every word in my book is genius. Otherwise, why would it be there? How can I justify cutting anything? I've already cut the bad stuff. So I don't think anybody should ever get involved in adapting their own work. Having said that, I do know something about TV production, having worked in it for 20 years. And I can see where the pinch points are going to be. I can see the important factors. So I've retained a certain amount of control over a certain amount of things, simply because I want to make sure it's done right. For instance, the soundtrack. I think with streaming television, soundtrack is more important than people realize. Mm-hmm. And so I want that done right. Various things like that. But I'm not going to be looking over their shoulder. I think that it's very important to let them do their job.
Well, I, for one, am very excited at the prospect of some binge-watching Jack Reacher in the future. I think it'll be great.
Lee Child, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. It's been a great pleasure and an honor for both of us. We really enjoy your work, and we like selling truckloads of it too.
Well, thank you, and I'm really, really happy to be on Booktopia. It's a pleasure.
And you can get hold of all of Lee Child's books at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.